Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, from free cash to cheap investing and handy money-saving perks, how to squeeze the most out of your work pension, and who does get it when you die. A reader may be shot of a bad relationship, but they're stuck in a mortgage with their ex, and he's not playing ball. What rights do you have? Also today, Lee gets a little bit grumpy about insurance tax, and M&S is back. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, modern work pensions are essentially cheap investment products provided and subsidised by your employer. Marvellous things that they are. But how many times have you looked under the bonnet to really investigate yours? Now, don't get me wrong, auto-enrolment takes the hassle out of saving for retirement, and more of us are taking advantage than ever before. But you could be missing a trick or two by not looking any further into it than that. So it is time to soup up your workplace pension. You have a number of tips and tricks, but Lee, welcome. Firstly, explain what is so good about a workplace pension. How do they work?
Oh, they're magic, Georgie. They're pure enough of magic. It's a way to give yourself a little pay boost, to be quite frank with you. So really stripping it all the way back, you have two types of workplace pension. You have defined benefit and a defined contribution. Now, most DB schemes are shut. They're done. They're those sort of gold-plated pensions. Some of our older listeners will definitely have them. But for most of us, we're talking about defined contributions. Now, what that is you have some of your salary deducted each month, your employer puts in some of the cash too, and you get tax relief from the government. That is the pure and simple way to think about your pension. You're putting a bit in, your workplace is putting a bit in, and you're getting some tax relief on that. Now, the issue is with it is that lots of people either don't save enough into it or think they're saving enough into it, and combined with their state pension will be enough. But we're all pretty much guilty of underestimating what we're going to need for our retirement pot to have the sort of lifestyle that you might be accustomed to now. And some people put it off, and totally understandably, especially in your 20s, when you're clambering to get on the property ladder, when you've got expensive life events, you know, you might be getting married, you get into your 30s and you might start having children, all that kind of like conventional stuff. All of that, it costs money. And lots of people put their pension to the side and think, well, that's a sort of tomorrow problem. And I totally understand that. It's completely, completely understandable. But with auto-enrollment, at the moment, the minimum set contribution to that is 8%. And that is made up of typically 5% that you pay in and 3% from employer. Now, that's from 10 grand upwards. If you earn under that, you have a legal right to request to be part of the scheme. But for most of us, we are now auto-enrolled into pensions as a way to force us into saving, basically, and forcing us almost to engage more with our pension. Now, one of the real big peeves that we've mentioned on this podcast before is that most of us have our workplace pension and it's in a default fund. I mean, that is the kind of real sort of like...
What do you mean by that, Lee? And what's the issue?
It's just an incredibly sort of bread and butter part of your pension. It's a very sort of seen as a safe investment. And it kind of, so it's basically say the pension scheme operator isn't so much on the hook for making sort of riskier decisions that, you know, might see your pension fall 1 year like harder than you'd expect type thing. It's meant to be a pretty safe and steady place to go. But that ain't where you're going to be getting the most investment growth on your pension pot. But tinkering with that can be also a bit of a minefield as well, because you don't want to end up in more expensive funds that aren't going to work hard for you. And it could take lots of decision making. Now, one thing I think that has happened with workplace pensions in recent years is that I think workplaces and pension providers are doing much more to sort of give their employees more tools to sort of go and log into your pension, have a look at future predictions, what certain meddling will do to your pension. And it's one of those kind of rainy day afternoon things that's definitely worth investigating. But from the real basic level, it is important to be putting money into your workplace pension. it is great that your employee is going to be putting in essentially free cash for you and the tax relief. And some employees will double what you put in, which is when it starts to get really tasty. Now, sometimes that's after certain years of service that you'll get that, but that will add value to your pension pot. And, you know, fundamentally, it is one of those things that I just think that we should engage more with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to be honest, I think more people do now. I think there is more talk around it, especially with auto enrollment. But it is really worth seeing how much you're currently putting in, playing around with some of the tools that your employer probably has, and seeing what your future pot's going to be, even if it's just to shock you into being like, yeah, ain't going to be enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably about as far as most people will go, Simon, isn't it? Just taking a look, playing with a calculator. But then what? I mean...
Yes. But the first point that I would make, and the first point that is made quite a lot of the time on this, is the reason why you should save into your work pension is if you don't do that, you are giving up free money. There are two places you're going to get free money. One, you're going to get it from pension tax relief, which is automatically added to the contributions that you make to your pension, not the contributions that your employer makes, but what you make. And that's basic rate tax is automatically added. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can claim the rest of it back. But that takes you back to the position that you were in before you paid tax. So you pay 20% tax. In order to get back there, you get a 25% uplift on what you pay in. Then your employer will pay in as well. And as Lee explained, under auto enrollment, you're committed to pay in a certain amount and your employer is committed to pay in a certain amount as well, unless you opt out. But most employers are more generous, or if you work there for longer than a certain amount of time, will become more generous than with auto enrollment. So, for example, you will find many, many employers out there who will match your contributions. And the reason why you should do this is simple. If I said to you, give me £100 and I will turn it into £225 right now, would you think that was a good deal? You're nodding along, saying yes.
Yes, apologies. Yes.
That's what your pension will do in this scenario. You pay in £100 each month. This basic rate tax relief will add £25. So that takes you up to £125. Your employer will then add £100 as well, matching your contribution. So you've got £225. So you've turned £100 into £225. There are not many places where you can instantly turn £100 into £225 in this world. And most of them, when they tell you you can do that, should be avoided like the plague, because they are scams. Okay? This is not a scam. This is your workplace pension. Your employer's offering it to you and the government's topping it up. Great deal. You then take your £225 a month. And imagine if you are unlucky enough that your salary never goes up for 40 years, right? You take your £225 a month and you just keep going the same £225 a month every single month for the next 40 years. You start at 25, you finish at 65, and you get a 5% return on your money that you've invested. After those 40 years, you will have £343,500, according to This Is Money's long-term savings calculator. That is a very, very healthy pension pot that is going to give you a pretty comfortable retirement. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about a comfortable retirement in today's prices. Unfortunately, a comfortable retirement is going to cost you more money in 40 years' time than it does now. The comfortable retirement costs you considerably more money now than it did 2 years ago, thanks to inflation. But your salary is probably going to go up. Your earnings are going to go up. Hopefully, we're going to get back to a scenario where earnings consistently go up by more than inflation. And that 5% return, actually, if you look at long-term global stock market returns, that 5% is a reasonable real return. So that's the return after inflation. So you could find yourself in a situation where you end up with considerably more than this, but I'm just using those simple numbers. Now, compare that to what happens if you just saved £100 a month. You didn't get the basic rate tax uplift. You didn't get the employer contribution. You just put £100 a month away, 40 years, got 5% return. That would only get you £153,000. So there's a very big difference there. And that's what taking that free money makes to you. And if you look at £100 a month, that is 5% of a £24,000 salary. So that's below the median salary. So once you start going above that, once you hit the median salary, or you start becoming someone who's above the median salary, you start getting into being a higher earner and so on. And I am almost guaranteed to be right in thinking that most people listening to this podcast aspire to be higher earners. They want to earn as much money as they possibly can, right? That's probably why they're listening to this money podcast. As you go up there and you keep paying in that percentage of your salary, and the government keeps giving you tax relief and your company keeps paying money in, your pension pot will build up and build up and build up. And the other thing I would say that's really important is the reason why you should start early is because the difference between that £225 a month going into your pension for 30 years and 40 years is quite substantial. Do it for 30 years, you will end up with £187,300. Do it for 40 years, as I said, you'll end up with £343,500. And that is why you should pay money into your work pension. And then you should do all these other things in Tanya's guide to try to make even more of your work pension than you possibly can.
Which leads us beautifully on. I mean, I like to think people listen to this for our sparkling personalities, witty repartee and cheeky banter. But Lee, Simon there has laid out, as you both have, the benefits of the workplace pension. And look, anyone listening who's a freelancer, hello, I am too. So there are benefits. Obviously, there's benefits to starting early, but neither of us here are particularly young, and our listeners probably don't have the benefit of going back in time travel. So look, what can you do now? Tanya has beautifully laid out some quick, easy wins, some surprising tricks and tips and whatnot. So, Lee Boyce, how can you soup up your pension?
Georgie, I'm still young. I'm only 36. I'm in the prime of my life.
Oh, get out. You're 36.
I was about to say,
we're all in our 40s here, aren't we?
Be a Premier League footballer, just about. Come on.
I remember when you were 12 years old, Lee. We're for snapper.
Well, talking about being young, and Simon there was obviously talking about the kind of differences if you start early and the contributions. And one thing is and in this guide, is thinking about growth when you're younger. You can take more risk with your pension when you're younger. So that is worth considering. So when you look at the products, potentially if you're going to come out of your default fund, is looking at the risk. Most of these funds have a risk factor, usually scaled to about 7, with a 6 and 7 being sort of extreme risk. Now, risk is one of those words you go, ooh, I don't like the sound of that. But you've got loads of time to go and try and build your pension pot. When you start to get a bit older in life and getting towards the thought sort of over the hump and coming down the mountain and looking at when you're going to retire, so sort of 50 onwards, you can go to Pension Wise is a good sort of place to go and have a look and almost sort of reassess where you're at and what you need to do. But it does start to become more about de-risking. And there's been quite a lot of talk about this in recent months, because it has been a little bit of a bit of turmoil in the last sort of 18 months in terms of markets. And some people have seen the value of their retirement sort of plunge and set back people's retirements by a few years. So getting all of that advice and as much as you can and just absorbing it is just massively crucial. And that's why I was saying about playing around with tools and calculators and all that sort of stuff, because they do try to guide you into making the right decisions and trying to build your wealth, you know, and that's ultimately what we want to do. We all want a comfortable retirement. You know, that's what we're looking for. And on that note as well, it's well worth looking at your state pension forecast as well. So we're talking about workplace pensions here, but obviously for many, the state pension will be a bit of a bedrock to your savings plans. Now, it's a whole other podcast if we start saying, what does the future of the state pension look like for when we're sort of in our 60s and 70s? But we can only talk about what's going on at the moment. And getting that state pension forecast will kind of give you an indication of what age you're going to get it from, because the goalposts are continuously moving, and how that then builds into your retirement plans. Now, some of the other things that are in this story that I think that are really worth considering, we are kind of a nation of job hoppers now. you know, lots of people move around, lots of different jobs, lots of different pots here, there, and the other, everywhere. I mean, my wife has got honestly four or five different pension pots that she gets correspondence about every year, and the fees are just eating into the small sort of small pots. Now, I think this is really interesting. We've got an expert in here in this story, Emma Byron from LNG, and she said, we're now a nation of job hoppers. I've just taken what she said, obviously. We're now a nation of job hoppers, but that doesn't mean that you can't take your pension pot with you when you leave for a new role and combine it with your pension in your new employer scheme. You'll be able to organize this with your employer, or you can leave it where it is if you prefer. I think that's quite an interesting little tidbit of information. I'm not sure that that is kind of widely known, that you could take your pension pot with you. So it's well worth, if you are someone that kind of, you know, dies around jobs, it's worth thinking about. Some of the other things that you should consider, we're going to talk about death benefits shortly and what it means, who gets your workplace pension when you pass away. But it is usually outside of inheritance tax. So that's a really important sort of thing to consider. I mean, that's a massively important point, but that is kind of getting obviously not to what you can do right now, but it's worth knowing that. I think it's worth having that piece of information. And I think fundamentally, it is just about not burying your head in the sand and using, for example, you could do these midlife MOTs. We've spoken about these on the podcast before. I think they're a really worthwhile endeavor. You know, you can go and sort of see where you're at in terms of your financial health, which sounds like a bit of a horrible terminology, but it is vastly important to be considering all of this stuff. And especially for those people that have ticked off all of those big life milestones, and it's kind of like, what's next? And retirement should be on your mind, whether you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s or 50s, in my mind. And the worst thing you can do is just to do nothing.
Right. Simon, any other tips to add to that?
Yes, I think one thing to consider avoiding is trying to be too clever.
It's lesson for life, Simon, I think.
I think it's a good, it's an investing thing, you know, more to be more accurate. So a lot of people will say, well, I don't invest, I don't play the stock market, I'm not gambling with my money. Now, most of those people will have a workplace pension, so they are investing. It is invested. And the default fund gives you an easy place for the money to go. And that's where most people's money goes, because most people don't engage with this stuff. If you go digging into your pension provider, you will find a selection of different funds. Now, depending on who your workplace has chosen to run their workplace pension, and whether your workplace has decided to put in place any kind of restrictions to stop you going off a bit wild and crazy and putting all your money into some incredibly racy fund, there might be a bit of restrictions on it that you wouldn't find, for example, if you just opened an account at any old DIY investing platform. You'll probably end up with quite a few choices, but sometimes those choices are very, very confusingly named. It's confusing enough looking at the names of funds when you look at one of the DIY investing platform giants, like at Hargreaves Lansdown, Interactive Investor, AJ Bell's site. The fund names are confusing there, but they are incredibly well labeled when you compare them to what some of the pension fund variations are called. And it can be quite difficult to work out exactly what your pension fund is, this pension fund is actually doing. So you need to spend a bit of time. If you're going to go anywhere different to the default, you need to spend a bit of time understanding what those other funds are. But you also need to understand what the default is doing. Ideally, what you want as your starting position is the cheapest possible global stock market tracker fund you can find. What that means is your money is spread across the global stock market, depending on the size of the markets. So, for example, the US makes up 60% of the global stock market. You might think the US market's overvalued. You might think that you want to be in a cheaper market and things like that. But the moment you move away from that, you're making an active decision that you're right and the market is wrong. And investing has a long history of people thinking that and then being proved that the market is more right than they are, and they're more wrong than they think. And I think with your pension, there's maybe an argument for at least the bulk of it or the core of it, just going into one of those big global stock market tracker funds. You just keep putting the money in every month, and it keeps building up. It keeps building up. Because if I look back at my own personal experience, you know, I too am one of those people who think that they know better and think that they can beat the market and think that they can make their pension grow quicker and their ISA grow quicker. I'm pretty sure that if I'd have just stuck all of my money into a global stock market tracker fund with very, very low fees, I'd have done better in my pension. I'd have done better in my ISA. Some of those investments that I chose have done much, much better than the cheap global stock market tracker fund. But the ones that didn't put a big enough hole in performance, that it means overall, on average, I probably should have decided that I wasn't smarter in this instance. Now, that is going back over a period in which the US stock market has been absolutely flying, which is why it makes up more than 60% of some of these global tracker funds. But if you're betting against the market, if you're deciding that you know better and you're right, you know, the UK stock market is cheap. It's very, very, very cheap at the moment. There are loads of great arguments as to why you should be putting money into the UK, because at some point people are going to wake up and notice, and there's going to be a catalyst, and the UK market's going to stop being so cheap. Even if it just went back to its long-term average, you'll make money. But in all the time, but that's been the case for years. And in all that time, that's been the case for years, and investors like me have been overweight to the UK. The US market's been there steadily making money year in, year out, year in, year out, year in, year out, or making more money. There's not been many years where it hasn't done better. Last year was one of them. And last year, the US market did much worse than the UK, but the UK did better by just about holding its head above water. And then lo and behold, this year, the US market rebounds by loads. So I think there's a real risk with your pension in particular, that because you're dealing with such a large and important sum of money for your future, that the wrong decisions can really cost you. If you're just doing it with some money in your investment account or in your ISA or something like that, it's not quite, doesn't have quite the same ramifications if you get it wrong. Whereas if all of a sudden you have started to build up that pension pot that I was talking about earlier, you know, you're on your way to your £343,500, and you start making some bad investment decisions that really put a hole underneath the waterline, that could cost you dear. Yeah. And then to go back to your point about self-employed people, I think it's really important if you're self-employed to get money into a pension regularly, mm-hmm. and try to automate mm-hmm. it as possibly can. Take the option away from yourself as much as you possibly can of stopping that monthly contribution. Mm-hmm. Or maybe if you've got, for example, I know it can be difficult to do it monthly, but a lot of self-employed people will build up a tax fund to pay their tax bill, because you've got to pay tax bill in lumpy ways. And a lot of self-employed people will overpay money into their tax fund because they're worried about their tax bill being bigger than they think it's going to be. And then at the end of the year, you're like, okay, great, I've got a bit more money in here than I thought. Take a chunk of that, put it in your pension. You know, try to build a system that means you can succeed, because it's very, very tempting, particularly if you're self-employed and you don't know where the next paycheck is coming from, to just go, oh, well, I can't really afford that this month. And then it's like the next month and you think, oh, I can't really afford that this month either. And then all of a sudden the year is gone and you haven't put any money in.
Well, I would say, as a freelancer who likes to gamify myself, having a provider with a really nifty, great app where you can just add as and when, and you're feeling a bit, yeah, I can add some more. Because otherwise, if you just set up, I don't know, a sort of minimum amount and you say, oh, yeah, at the end of the year, I'll whack in however much I've got left over, chances are you probably won't. But you'll probably save a little bit more if you could kind of do it as you go along, Lee.
Yeah, I think that's sound advice, Georgie. And actually, yeah, a couple of things I was going to say is I'm a big advocate for one-off financial advice. Like, I think it could be quite important to pay. You know, it's going to cost you, but you can get that kind of expert insight. And if you're really sort of unsure, you know, what it could be worth doing. Somewhere like Unbiased, you can go and find a financial advisor that might be able to help you with a one-off kind of bit of advice, and having a look under the bonnet of your pension and whatnot. And also, there's been a big rise in recent years of sort of money coaches. There's a lot of employers and pension firms that now offer kind of money. I hate that terminology, money coaching. But again, it might offer you something that you might not have thought of or not thought about, and can be well worth investigating.
Do you know what, Lee? You know how I like to multitask. I like to do most of my financial admin while we do this podcast. I've just written there on my to-do life list. I have to do life, to do work, pension advisor. It's something that I've wanted to do for a while as a freelancer, but keep putting it off. It's one of those things, isn't it? Actually, to be fair, there's a lot of those things in finance, sadly. Before we move on from this subject, though, I was actually having this discussion with a mate the other day. Yes, we have these kind of exciting chats, and quite morbid as well. What does happen to your workplace pension if you die? They recently just, well, they're going through a divorce, hence why the conversation was being had. It's almost like Tanya read our minds. She answered the question far, far more fully and eloquently than I ever could. So what does happen to your workplace pension when you die?
Georgie, I've got to say, I'd love to have been in the pub chat there and
you
how
wouldn't.
That came up. I mean, blimey. But actually, it is a really good point because, you know, we do have slightly messier lives these days, I would argue. Mm-hmm. You know, people do, you know, get divorced maybe more so than other decades. And whenever we write about a pension in divorce, a story like that, you know, it becomes a bit of a pile-on in the reader comments, and people are kind of like, you know, you can get a little bit spicy out there. The real important thing to think about and know, and I'm going to be honest, I've never really given this an awful lot of thought because I just sort of thought, well, it goes to my next, again, it just goes to my wife. I've just not really sort of thought about it. But there is an expression of wishes form that you should fill in. I've not filled this in, full disclosure. I am going to go and investigate whether I need to go and fill this in and whereabouts I find it. And that will essentially, you put down who you want your beneficiary to be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it goes to that person. Because I know it sounds a bit bonkers, doesn't it? They exercise, basically, the people that run the scheme will exercise discretion over who ultimately benefits from your pension. But if you put your wife down or your husband down, it is very, 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 very likely it's going to go to them. But it can get messy if you've divorced and you haven't changed that expression of wishes form. Easily done. We mentioned earlier about there being lots of different pension pots out there. So it's not just that you have one expression of wishes form for, you know, your current employer and that applies to all. You will need to go and find out from other pension pots that you've got to make sure that your expression of wishes form is up to date. Now, it's incredibly morbid. I think lots of people just, again, just wouldn't think about this sort of thing. But it is massively important to figure this out because there's nothing worse than having to sort of unravel this kind of thing after a tragedy is unfolded. It's the last thing that basically, you know, states want to have to go through and sort out. And I think that Tanya's great at this. She brings these kind of things to life and brings these things to the forefront of, as you say, it's kind of like a bit of pub chat, who's getting my pension? And then Tanya's kind of like, you know, writes these things. And I'll be honest, it's an education for me sometimes. I read these pension stories and I think, never thought of that. Really should think of that. Why have I never thought of that? But I think it's a part of our brain. We don't like to think of worst case scenario. But it is important. As I mentioned earlier, pension funds don't normally form part of an estate for inheritance tax purposes. So you should just know what your expression of wishes form says. And if you do one thing next week, maybe that's it, because that's what I'm going to do.
I've already done that. But I was curious because it's interesting. You said it's just an expression of wishes and your pension provider decides who should get it. It's not something that goes in your will, is it?
My understanding is that it's what you put given your pension provider that decides it. And whether you've written into your will, I want my pension to go to so-and-so, doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
But like, obviously, as Lee said, these things can be, it's much easier to challenge this than it is to challenge a will, for example. And if you said something in your will and then there was something else in your pension and you'd said that in your pension years ago, but you'd written your will more recently, then you would think there would then be a case for it being changed. And that there's a really good point on the old pension stuff there because people forget. And going back to the whole start your pension in your 20s thing, people will start their pension in their 20s and their pension provider will say, who do you want it to go to if you die? They'll go, well, I don't know.
Mum?
And but usually your parents is the worst option, right?
Oh.
The better option would be a sibling, for example.
Yeah. Mine's my siblings.
You Yeah. So, or multiple siblings. So, for example, I had this conversation with my wife a while back. Again, we have very interesting conversations, much like your pub conversations, Georgie. And I can't remember why we're talking about this. And she said, because she's got old pensions and work. Well, I don't know where that goes to. I mean, what happens if I die? She said, I think when I opened it, I put down my sister. She said, I'd like to think that if anything happened to me, my sister would give it to you. Said, or the kids. Oh. I mean, you know, but there would be scenarios where potentially the person might go, no, I'm not giving it to you.
Yeah, I'm sure there would be.
So yeah, it is an issue. With the inheritance thing on pensions, there is a lot of talk that is going to be changed. It's seen as, so what happens is if you die under the age of 75, mm-hmm. then, and you leave your pension to someone, it's free of tax. If you're over the age of 75, the person that you leave it to is taxed on their marginal rate when they take money out of that pension. Now, when we're talking about large sums in pensions and the fact that the money that they take out of that pension is then going to be added to their income to decide their marginal rate, you would probably find that unless people took very, very small amounts out of pension over a very long period of time or were very low earners, then they'd end up bumping themselves into the higher rate tax bracket anyway. So there'd be 40% tax paid on the money that was quite a lot of the money that was being taken out. So there's no inheritance tax saving in that instance. If someone's bumping themselves into 40% tax, they might even end up paying more because they might bump themselves into 45% tax by taking out a big lump sum from the pension. Under the age of 75, it feels like a quirk, but I've always thought that, you know, ultimately, if you're somebody whose relative has died under the age of 75 and they've left you their pension, your relative has died early and you're not winning there.
No, quite.
Maybe it's just like, okay, well, you know what? They've died early. And so, yeah, you end up with a little tax break on some of the money that has been left to you. But to be honest, you'd probably rather they were alive rather than dead in most cases. So that's the way I have genuinely seen it. I don't see it as a major issue, but I know there are lots of people out there who do find it to be a major issue for them and would like to have this system changed.
On that cheery note, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam Lord-Vittorio for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Hi, Simon. Yeah, well, this time last week, we thought it would be a relatively quiet week, and it has been, to be honest. Stocks started well, but they've come off their best levels. The rally that we have seen over the last couple of weeks was fueled by the drop in oil prices and a more dovish set of central bank meetings. This week, Bitcoin has led the push higher across different asset classes, which is now really starting to show its resilience to everything else that's going on. Also this week, China's deflation concerns have resurfaced. On the brighter side of things, the US actor strike has finally come to an end. Meanwhile, Disney exceeded market expectations with their strong earnings, but the news wasn't so positive for WeWork, which filed for bankruptcy. Additionally, Eli Lilly has received approval for a new weight loss drug. Elsewhere, precious metals such as gold have fallen as the bid for safe haven assets has dwindled a little bit. We've also seen cocoa rise to a 45-year high following weather distraction too.
Thank you very much. And what do we have to look forward to next week, Sam?
Yeah, in the upcoming week, there's a few factors that I think are worth keeping an eye on. US core inflation, probably the number one, that might dip below 4%, which will potentially support the bond market rally, while the government shutdown also looms. So again, worth keeping an eye on that. China's October events, you've got Singles Day and also a meeting between Xi Jinping and Biden will influence markets there as well. That'd be the October data, of course. Major retailers like Walmart, Home Depot, Target all report their earnings as well, so always worth keeping an eye on consumer sentiment there. And for those that care about it, in Argentina you've got the runoff election on the 19th as well, which could of course impact the economic and political trajectory of that country.
And Argentina's economy is worth an entire podcast on itself, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I don't know if we've got enough time for that in this one.
Yeah, I won't ask you to explain all of the potential problems there in the time that we have left.
Yeah,
very much for that.
Thanks,
and
Simon.
Speak to you next week.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We spoke about divorce and relationship breakdowns earlier. Never easy, is it? Tends to be fairly substantially harder when money is involved. It is reader question time. My partner and I separated 18 months ago, says a reader, and we're now selling our property. To save on the large early repayment charge, I looked at porting the mortgage to a new property. Santander has sent me an offer and everything looks great. The only thing is, my ex-partner is now not agreeing to me porting it. Can he stop me from doing this? It is on a low fixed rate, so I'm keen to utilise this and escape the £12,000 early repayment charge. Broker David Hollingworth, the broker of personal finance journalists everywhere, has answered. What did he say? I'm just curious to know, why was the other half, the ex, not keen on going ahead? Tell me the story.
I have absolutely no idea, Georgie, to be honest with you. I don't think that formed part of the question. I don't think that we were told kind of why the other person is being so difficult.
I want to know how they broke up. I want to know how bitter it got.
That's got to get in the gossip pages.
I would probably hazard a guess that they don't really want to remain on a mortgage on a new property with their ex that they don't actually live in. And that whilst it might save them some early repayment charges until the mortgage is up for renewal, they probably feel that it's better to make a clean break rather than end up on the mortgage of their ex-partner's property.
Right. And they can't, once you've ported it over, dump... let's hear what David had to say. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself here because I'm just too nosy.
Yeah, so, I mean, essentially, Georgie, now it's not a question of, you know, who's keeping the dog or who's keeping the toaster. It's who's keeping the mortgage. I think that's maybe what's going on a little bit in these kind of scenarios. And I've had lots of, in the last year, like, honestly, lots of people that I know that are kind of in this scenario in which, you know, breaking up and selling a house and it gets complicated. The added complication now is that mortgage rates are much higher than they were 2 years ago. Property market is a little bit running a bit dry, so it's difficult to find two homes if you're breaking up and trying to sort of split up in that kind of way. Now, the way I read this story is I can understand why people want to port part of the mortgage away because you want to keep hold of that low rate. And I actually wasn't too sure what the rules are around this, to be honest. And dodging an early repayment charge, you know, it was obviously massive. You don't want to be paying sort of 12 grand. Now, David actually said in this that I think this is really interesting. So he said some couples are negotiating over who gets to keep the mortgage. And because the current fixed rate was taken at a low point, it could still have a number of years left to run. Not all lenders can enable a mortgage to be split and ported by the two separating borrowers, but a number can. So Santander is one of the lenders that can split a mortgage. So you can actually split the mortgage and port it. I didn't know that. I actually genuinely didn't know that. And I think that is a really interesting point, that if you know someone or are in the process of this yourself, it is well worth investigating. So if you're both looking to then go and buy a property, it's kind of a fair way of splitting it and also avoiding, a 12 grand hit on the ERC. But it depends on the circumstances. It depends if the other person is going to buy. It sounds brilliant on paper, but these things can be messy and complicated, and, you know, we don't know. As Simon rightly points out, and as David points out in this column, it would be a bit bizarre to be porting the mortgage and keeping the partner on the mortgage. Yeah, you can totally understand why the partner, you know, the ex-partner in that scenario would be like, that doesn't sound good. But you can port it on your own. You might need partner's consent. But your lender might be cautious if your partner's raised an objection, which it sounds like in this scenario.
Simon, you want to think about lessons that we can take from this and, you know, to go forth for the listener. Choose your partner more wisely. I don't know. Like, where are we going with that? What's the lesson here? What can we learn, Simon?
Well, what we can learn from this is that there's a reason for people to want to keep their mortgage nowadays that there wasn't potentially 2 years ago. Well, whereas you might have been able to afford it by yourself or just to get a new mortgage, even if you were willing to pay the early repayment charge at 2% rates, you might not be able to do that, or it's highly unlikely you'll be able to do that by yourself at 5% rates. And breakups get messy. And also that, and I've seen this in a number of, you know, things I've been told about occasions, you know, work, personal, all these kinds of things that come across your bowels, is that people can be unreasonable, or what seems unreasonable to the other partner in this kind of scenario. And you can end up in scenarios where people put in very different amounts of money to purchase properties. They put in very different amounts of money to pay the mortgage on those properties. They put in very different amounts of money to do up a property. And that, unfortunately, that one side of the equation will sometimes refuse to recognize that after the event, and will argue for more than if you sat down and looked at it on a piece of paper. Most people would judge that they are due. And there is a problem whereby, unless you lay this stuff out carefully and properly and in a full legal fashion beforehand, you can end up in a scenario where the person can try to claim more than they're due and end up getting more than they're due. So for example, there are different ways of holding properties. Joint tenants, which means it's 50-50. That's the default position. You both own it 50-50, and there's tenants in common. And you can do tenants in common, and then you can get a legal declaration that says, you know, so-and-so put in this amount, so-and-so put in that amount. And if the property gets sold, you know, partner A gets the first X amount back, partner B gets the next Y amount back. And that lays it out. And that means that if something does happen, then you have got the recourse to that, and it means it's all been laid out and it's all legally done. And then you do that, and then you move on and you divide it up, however, after that's been settled. And this is something that's used quite often when people are buying with unequal amounts because they've got unequal deposits. And that's a very common scenario nowadays, due to the bank of mum and dad having to fund so many property purchases, and the bank of mum and dad helping somebody to buy with their partner, you know, in their late 20s, has a big concern about what happens if they split up. What happens if I give my son or my daughter, you know, a very large amount of my lifetime wealth, if I give them tens of thousands of pounds and then they split up and the other partner tries to claim half of that? So that's why, you know, people will do these tenants in common agreements, and then the declaration afterwards that says, you know, they get the first amount there, they get the next amount there. And it might be that further down the line, perhaps they get married, they have children or whatever, they go, do you know what, from now on, this point on, it's just going to be 50-50, whatever happens. And then you start getting into the scenario where if you have divorce and stuff, then you will, you know, if it gets disputed, then you will start having the legal process that goes through deciding, you know, who gets what and so on in a divorce, which is much more complicated. So it can get a lot more complicated than just who gets to keep the mortgage. It's the short answer to that.
I was going
to
say, we spoke about sort of messy arrangements and blended families and marriages, second marriages, third marriages, maybe. Goodness me, couldn't it get confused?
So, yeah, so basically my point is, don't just bank on your partner being reasonable in the event that you break up, because I have heard of lots of scenarios in my life where it turns out the partner is not reasonable.
Shock. Oh, my God, shock. Lee?
I think if you're in this scenario and you are, you know, divorcing and you've got a mortgage, you know, the first port of call really should be your lender to discuss all of the options. You know, what can you actually do? Can you split the mortgage in terms of porting? You know, and where, and really crunching the numbers of, if you're selling the property and taking away any fees and all that kind of stuff, what are you left with and how's that being split? But it's incredibly messy. And as Simon says, you know, people can start off reasonable, and then quite often what I hear is that it gets very unreasonable very quickly. So having all of your sort of legal, you know, stuff dotted and knowing what you're doing is massively important.
Yes, indeed it does. We could go on about this for a lot longer, I'm confident, but we've got a couple more stories to do. And insurance premium tax. Snore, snore, snore. Not exactly something you'd imagine has got under the skin of our Lee Boyce. Most of us have probably never heard of it. But indeed, it has got under the skin of Lee. So much so that you've been tapping away at your laptop, or whatever, and written your article on it. Lee, what is IPT? Why does it have you all hot and bothered?
It's one of those things, George, isn't it? I mean, we are in a kind of personal finance world where there's so many acronyms and boring terminology that you could quite honestly just go, God, that sounds dull. What do I want to know about? And if it doesn't pass the sort of my wife test, and I know it's really boring. So if I said to her, what's IPT? She'd be like, what? I don't know. Insurance premium tax. Well, don't talk to me about that. That sounds so boring. And it's basically just a tax that's levied on insurers, and then insurers in turn basically bill their customers, and you pay it. You're basically paying the IPT. But where it wasn't too much of a problem before, it's become a growing problem to the point now where each household forks out around about £264 a year just in insurance tax. And your premium is likely to be higher than that if you tick all the boxes of having a home, driving a car, having a pet that you insure, and go on holiday quite a bit, because it's likely that your IPT bill is going to be even higher than that.
That's a lot for something you've probably never heard of.
It is exactly that. And that's why I was getting all hot and bothered, Georgie. You know, it's going straight into the Treasury coffers. So give you a quick potted history of IPT. It was first introduced in 1994 at a rate of 2.5%. It then, in 1997, went up to 4%. 1999, 5%. Then it was untouched for a very, very long time. Then a certain Mr. Osborne got involved with IPT, and it went up to 6%. Then in 2015, it went up to 9.5%. 2016, 10%, and it now sits since 2017 at 12%. The reason why that was meddled with is the average person, is to go back to circle back right to the start, will go, IPT, that doesn't affect me. What is that? You know, it's a very clever, easy way for the Treasury to be raking in some extra cash without you really knowing what it's for. But the thing is, in the late 90s, it was kind of raking in about £1.5 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at. You know, it's a lot. And then by sort of 2011-12, it was up to £3 billion. But now, the most recent sort of look at this, the most recent financial year, 2022-23, £7.45 billion, and that's up from £6.79 billion in the financial year before. That's a massive whack. And the reason why this is also, I kind of got a bee in my bonnet about this, is we are hearing from readers left, right, and centre about car insurance and home insurance quotes that are far higher than what they were previously, despite nothing changing. And all the noise that we're getting from insurers is that things have got more expensive. You know, cars are more expensive, they're more complicated to repair. There's been a massive subsidence claims in recent years, all these sorts of things. But lots of us just sit there and go, but none of this has happened to me. Or, you know, how is this all being justified? But to take car insurance as an example, so car insurance has been absolutely rocketing, George. I mean, it's up, according to the Association of British Insurers, it's up 29% in the last year. There's a shortage of parts, there's a shortage of skilled mechanics. You know, cars are more expensive to repair now. The mechanics behind a car, the computer chips, all of the sort of different technology, it's becoming more expensive, you know, simply put. Energy bills as well, you know, the people that fix your car, the energy that's required, the cost of that has gone up, and all these things are nibbling away and made insurance more expensive. But now, so basically £561 is the typical car insurance cost paid, and that's really comprehensive data from the ABI. But £60 of that now is IPT. You know, that's incredible. And I think that essentially the ABI's got a bit more cross about this as the years have gone by, and is calling for Jeremy Hunt to basically reduce it in the autumn statement. You know, we're still in a cost of living crisis. People have seen bills go up left, right and centre everywhere. And it's one of these kind of like behind the scenes taxes that I don't think people are quite
so annoying.
And I think
it's one of those like the stealth taxes, you know, it's just exactly. How can we squeeze a little bit more money so that people might not notice?
I think exactly that. And that's exactly, I mean, it was clever. I mean, it was exactly what it was kind of there for. But then more people wise up to it and go, but in this data that the ABI have got, only 2 in 5 people have heard of insurance premiums. That's got no idea what it is, if it even exists, what on earth it is. And the likelihood is for the 2023-24 financial year, the IPT take's going to be even higher, because as it's a chicken and egg, insurance costs keep on going up. So the IPT take keeps on going up. So it's likely that that 7.4 billion big figure is going to be even more than that. I think people could swallow it a little bit more if they knew where the money was going, if it was ring fenced for certain things. When George Osborne did tinker with it, when he put it up by 0.5% in 2016, he mentioned that that 0.5 percentage point rise would be used for flood defences in Britain. Okay, kind of makes sense. The trouble is, and as we always say on this podcast about things like that, George, do we tangibly ever see the evidence of where this money is actually all going? You know, the 7.4 billion figure, is that really going on everything you could possibly think of that would be to do with insurance, like flood defences, road safety? I'm not convinced. And motorists as well, let's face it, road tax, fuel duty.
Oh, the roads at the minute are ridiculous as well.
The tax take on motorists is absolutely incredible. And this is just yet another tax take on motorists when you pay for your car insurance. And I think the real nub of this as well is that lots of people, increasingly so, with bills rising, are skipping insurance.
Yes, exactly.
You know, if you don't buy car insurance, you know, you're not only doing yourself a disservice, but if you have an accident, the person that you have an accident with is also, you know, going to be in plenty of bother. So anything I think that can be done to help lower insurance costs and make sure that people are fully covered and fully protected and not cutting corners is vastly important. And it feels at the moment that IPT has become a very, very unfair tax. When you consider that the tax take has gone from 1.79 billion in 1997-98 to 7.45 billion now. And it was only, I say only, but it was 3 billion in 2011-12. Those stats to me are absolutely mind-boggling. And the sort of thing that I hate that unfairness. And I hope now that instead of only 2 in 5 people know about it, I hope people listen to this podcast and hopefully that will nudge up to more like 3 in 5. But, you know, we try.
Keep going, Lee. Keep going. Simon?
Slightly more than inheritance tax. It took in 2022. And we don't like inheritance tax. We've always grumbled about inheritance tax and there's calls to cut it. And there's also headlines about how much the government is cashing in on inheritance as well. But actually, IPT managed to take in more, because it's a small amount charged to a very, very large amount of people on a hell of a lot of things. And I do think it is about outrageous. It's one of those, it is a proper stealth tax. We talked about stealth taxes the other week on income tax and about how arguably it's not a stealth tax anymore if the government just says it's going to do it and has been doing it for years and now everybody's noticed and is really, really cross about it with the freezing of the tax thresholds. This one is stealthy. Most people don't realise anywhere near how much this is taking off them in little dribs and drabs on different insurances over the years and then is raking in total. And it's a classic example of a tax that started out as one thing in a relatively small amount and then has grown into others. And I'm not even going to get started on the state of the roads, apart from to say something I have said many times before on this podcast. You can tell a lot about a country by the state of its roads.
Right. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, probably many times, but I remember back in the day when I was a rookie sports reporter and I had the Northeast beat. And one of the old journalists pointed to the lights around the stadium and many were off or broken. And he said, you can tell the state of a sports club by the number of lights that are off. And I kind of think it's the same with the roads. Those were the bad old days in Newcastle, now a flood with money. So I'm sure all their lights are very much on. Finally, pants and sock wearers of Britain rejoice. M&S is back. I mean, it didn't technically go anywhere, but the doldrums for a little while. In the latest figures from the High Street Stalwart, Marks & Spencer's profits far exceeded forecasts due to a rise in food sales and the revival of its clothing ranges. So does that mean the juggernaut has finally turned? And what does a revival in the fortunes of just one store mean? A chain, albeit, but for the great British High Street. What does it mean?
I'm going to claim this as good news.
I, for one,
and I actually think that my view is reflected by many people. I, for one, am pleased that M&S has finally got it back together and is back on the up. And I think they're actually going to sustain it this time. Food has always been a strong point for M&S in the years when it's been struggling with its clothing, but it has struggled with its clothing. over recent years, there has been the comment that you walk through an M&S, there is a gazillion types of every single same thing. You want a shirt or you want a pair of trousers. You've got 30 different choices of the same pair of trousers. You know, it's even worse for women, and it's jumpers. A bit like a jumble sale. And M&S has suffered, I think, over the years due to the fact that there's a little quirk around the corner from This Is Money Towers, which is also the Daily Mail office building. And there's a cut through between where our offices are and High Street Kensington Station. And that cut through takes you through M&S, and it takes you through the women's wear department of M&S. And it means that the journalists on, you know, the country's largest newspapers, online operations, and everything like that are walking in and out of M&S all day long. So they're seeing exactly what it's like. So M&S gets judged on that, I think, you know, certainly in our organization. I think that's probably true elsewhere. People go into M&S lots and they look at it and they go, it's not looking great. But that's changed. M&S, and this actually goes back, I think, at least a year and a bit, a couple of years, really started to get things together. I am hearing loads of really positive things about its clothes. Women's wear is the big thing, you know, and I'm hearing loads of positive stuff from women that I know about M&S's clothes. I'm reading loads of positive articles. I'm reading loads of talk about how this is the thing you've got to have, and it comes from M&S. I went in there about 6 weeks ago, and I wanted to buy something for my wife to treat her because she's, you know, been doing loads and loads of stuff to help us out, doing a load of work on our house. And I wanted to go buy something, and I found a top in there. I was like, that looks great. She'd absolutely love that. I bought it for her. I brought it home. She's like, this is great. I absolutely love it. And it's things like that that is why M&S is doing well at the moment. And I, for one, am happy. After all of the bad retail news that we have had in recent years, it's really nice to see a British retailer on the high street that is doing really well and is back on its way up. And I genuinely hope that this continues.
Lovely, Simon. Lovely. Lee, then what are the latest figures? That's sort of Simon's anecdotal evidence there. But what are the actual figures, and how has this been achieved?
Well, profits are up 75% to 360 million for the 6 months to September. And it was way above expectations, and share price is up. And everyone's happy. I mean, Stuart Matchin, the chief exec, was very happy because he even tweeted the This Is Money story. So he must have been sitting at his desk thinking, here we go. Yeah, I'm going to post this. This Is Money story. I love that. I love it when things like that happen. I'm going to go into a few confessions here. Now, firstly, I like M&S. I think it's one of those shops that is good. And it's one of the things I like about it is it's very innovative when it comes to food. I think that it always kind of pushes the boundaries, and there's always something that keeps you interested in there. And I do quite frequently go to the one in the high street up in Rayleigh here where I live. And I like it. It's good. And my wife likes it. In-laws like it. It's one of those shops that just hits the mark. Now, a few other things here that I think are worth considering. I think, first of all, I'd like to see John Lewis play a little bit out of the playbook from M&S here, because I think it's had a rocky few years, and I think you could learn quite a few lessons from M&S and the way it's done things. Second of all, I was sad enough last night, we're recording this on a Friday, I was sad enough to watch the ITV programme Inside M&S, which was on. Now, the remote control was lost. A certain somebody might have fallen asleep on the couch, and I was kind of forced into watching it, kind of semi-forced into watching it. And it was really interesting. They were talking about opening the new Lakeside store, again, which is not a million miles from where I am here. And the new stores that are opening look so much better. And they were focusing on the store in Stevenage, which looked absolutely fantastic compared to some of the stuffy sort of, you know, let's face it, some of the M&S stores that are going to be a bit rough around the edges. They've been around for a very long time. I think that kind of strategy is clearly working. They had interviews with the sort of food department and the ladies' clothes buyer, talking about how they get all the trends, all that kind of stuff. It was actually quite fascinating, lifting the lid of one of the, you know, big high street names. It was interesting. But last confession, though, I've never, ever bought a pair of socks from M&S. I know I'm a Pringle guy. TK Maxx, £9.
All I'm thinking is crisps, pairs. But I don't think you mean the crisps.
I've gone through a lot. I've gone through a lot of socks in my life, and trying to figure out what the best brand are. And for me, I figured it out after 36 years on this earth that it is Pringle. That the socks are second to none. Highly recommend. But if you've got a different sock choice and you're really the advocate for M&S socks, please do let me know. But you're not going to change my mind, I don't think.
It's not socks for me, it's pants. I've tried. I'm the same with pants.
I didn't think no. wanted Mark's to know where I get my pants from. I thought
that's finally no. With that kind of open, honest podcast, you know, it's. I think most of the nation probably still get their pants from Marks and Spencer's.
I've never had M&S pants either. No, I'm a Ted.
Oh, baby. Lee, get
I'm stopping
out.
That. I'm stopping.
Well, what I would say is that one of the things that is a little bit unfortunate about some of these M&S results is that it's been doing so well off the back of some of its competitors closing down, but also the financial performance has been helped by the fact that it has shut some of its stores. And so there are now some towns that once had an M&S and now do not have an M&S anymore. And I haven't watched the ITV programme. I've heard the Stevenage one is very big and very special, but I believe that that did come at the expense of M&S, unfortunately, shutting down the M&S in Wellington City, which was a big dent to Wellington City, which no is doubt. Just down the road from Stevenage. So, local news brought to you by the This Is Money podcast.
This has gone to a level. I mean, Lee, I'll be honest with you, watching a programme about a big shop in Stevenage, you didn't sell it for me. But
it was like watching one big advert, I must admit, and I was sitting there sort of questioning my life, but I just thought it wasn't worth, you know, trying.
I feel like you preceded enough for control. Me.
It felt kind of a bit like Chinese water torture with TV form. But to be honest, it was one of those kind of like warm, fuzzy, easy things.
Own
to
it.
Watch. You know, I'm it's owning fine. It. I loved it.
No one's judging you.
For next
but
week.
What
wait.
We want to know is
if he comes into work on Monday morning and says that over the weekend he did the hour and a half journey to the M&S in Stevenage to check it out for an afternoon.
Got
out.
The autograph.
I will stage
the manager.
An intervention.
I think you should. But look, on a final uplifting, hopefully, point on this one is that thank you, Lee, for telling us that we don't need to watch that documentary series. What would the conclusion, Simon Lambert, be? Is this going to last, this turnaround, bearing in mind what you just said about the figures? And if it does, what does it mean for our great British high street? Is it back to?
We've had a number of false dawns at M&S over the years. I think this isn't a false dawn. I genuinely think that they are getting it back together, which is why I'm quite pleased to see this. I think that as a wider point, it's not the only retailer high street retailer doing better, although we refer to them as high street retailers, but I don't know how accurate that is now, seeing as many of them have left the high street. Next, for example, also doing very, very well at the moment. And we have seen a big trend to the return to the high street, and it's the fast fashion online retailers, the Boohoos and the ASOSes of this world, who have been suffering as people have decided to go back to the high street, try stuff on, see things in real life. You know, obviously the end of the pandemic has helped there, and also those fast fashion retailers are being squeezed by incomers like Shein. And it would be nice to see a sustained improvement in bricks and mortar shopping in this country. I love shopping online. It is hugely convenient, but I would really like to see the revival of our high streets.
Do you know, it's one of those things, and I don't mind shopping online for anything else, but I never, ever buy clothes online. Ever. Lee's shaking his head. I just think, especially with women, I don't want to like situations like with men, but I mean, you are pot luck of what sizes they are. I mean, I think half the time they just say the size to make you try and feel better, but it's just nonsense. So I really hope that bricks and mortar is here to stay, or I'm going to be wearing some very old clothes for a very long time, Lee.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree, Georgia. I don't buy clothes online. I think I made the mistake of being about 18 or 19 and buying an ASOS, like getting an ASOS order. Half of it I didn't want to keep and I never took it back. And I think that was the death knell for me. I just thought, what am I doing? I much prefer shopping for clothes in person. I really don't buy anything now online. Although the one area of my life where I have gone online is supermarket shopping for the first time. And that has actually been a game changer. I've got outside the dinosaur times and actually get a regular shop, like an adult, which is quite nice. But that's a different ballpark. That's a different game.
Yeah. I mean, we could go on forever, but we're not going to, because that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, anywhere you can buy your pants and socks. Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past, join in the debate, read comments, and argue amongst yourselves about where you like to shop or buy socks or buy pants. And also, if you like this podcast and you've got this far, then I'm going to work on the basis that you do. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/lunchmoney to find our new Lunch Money show twice a week, Tuesday and Thursday. It's a video show. It's under 10 minutes. Tells you what you need to know about money that day. And so give it a try. See what you think.
And also, if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.